When Robert Pinsky was poet laureate of the United States, he inaugurated what he called the Favorite Poem Project. You see, he had a hunch that poetry was not something loved only by the intellectually elite, but that people all across the spectrum of America either loved poetry in general or had a favorite poem. And when he called for people to submit their favorite poems, in the first year, 18,000 Americans submitted a favorite poem. They ranged in age from 5 to 94. They ranged in education from an elementary school education to postgraduate, post-PhD work. He discovered that his hunch was right. There was a great love for poetry, or at least a poem, among people throughout our land. I mention this simply to underscore the fact that the Psalms are poetry, not prose. Scan any modern translation of the Bible, and you can immediately see which parts are set apart as poetry. The old King James Bible failed to do that. But any modern translation sets poetry apart so that you can see it in the text. And you soon discover that the majority of the poetry in the Bible is found in the Psalms and in the prophets. Those are the two places which arguably are the two most powerful parts of the Old Testament. It's in the prophets that we get those marvelous images of justice rolling down like waters, of the lion lying down with the lamb, of swords being beaten into plowshares. It's in the poetry of the Old Testament that we hear those marvelous words that we read before Christmas each year: in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be lifted up, and every mountain and hill made low. The uneven ground will become level, and the rough places a plain. This language gave people hope for the future. Now, when I speak of the language of poetry, I'm not trying to be an English professor here. I'm not trying to teach about the technical aspects of Hebrew poetic parallelism, nor anything about the length and nature of Hebrew strophes. I'm talking about language that moves and jumps and surprises. Language that evokes images and opens up brand new worlds and creates fresh possibilities that stretch our imagination. That's what I'm talking about. Good religion, healthy religion, is never literalistic. It is always poetic. When we open the Bible, especially to the Psalms, we are entering a poetic world. That means we are entering a world that is not embarrassed by strong emotions or by irrational images. It's a world that sometimes scrambles metaphors, hurls images like major league fastballs, stretches our imaginations, and knocks down the walls of our prosaic world in which most of us are trapped every day of the week. We cannot afford to to be limited to the flat world of techno-speak, a world that is as flat as the sound of a computer voice. Consider a person contemplating her life and the presence of God 3,000 years ago. Imagine that she's standing on the beach in what is now the Gaza Strip with no bombs going off. She's standing on the beach and she's wondering about God and her own life. She's trying to wrap her mind around God. She looks out at the Mediterranean Sea. And being a person of her times, she thinks the earth is flat, and she looks out and she sees that horizon out there, and she thinks that that's the end of the ocean. And she wonders, what's beyond that line? She looks to the east, and it's early morning. She sees the sun rising. She wonders about the sun. She stands there contemplating her life and her inevitable death. And she starts thinking about an ancient poem that she has learned. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you're there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you're there. And then she looks again at the sun. And as a person of her age, she thinks that the sun is like a bird flying over her head. And it flies all the way through the sky until at the end of the day, it dives into the water. And she thinks to herself, if I take the wings of the morning, the wings of the morning, and I dwell at the farthest limits of the sea, even there, your hand shall lead me and your right hand shall hold me fast. Now, this is not stale prose. This is poetic imagery. This is the language of worship. It is intended to challenge our prosaic world that assumes that things must always remain the way they are. It is language, in other words, that calls us to a better world of faith. That's the reason this Psalm 95, which Ahuma read so beautifully, begins with an invitation. In fact, it has two invitations. To come. An invitation to come together in worship. The reason the early Baptists who built this beautiful structure called this place a meeting house is that they understood that in coming together for worship, we enter a brand new world. A world of hope that counters the prosaic reality of their lives during the week. It is a world of transforming poetic language that is for all of us. For all of us can equally participate in this poetic drama of worship. Oh, come, let us make a joyful noise to the rock of our salvation. Now, a prosaic world looks at that invitation and concludes that it's talking about singing to a rock. What is this? A pet rock? Do we come together and sing to a rock? That is prosaic literalism. But to participate in the Psalms, we must let go of such literalism and experience the meaning of the metaphor. All through the Psalms, God is compared to a rock and a fortress. In fact, that was the best and strongest human defense system they knew, a stone fortress. It was the equivalent to the missile defense system that Israel calls the Iron Dome. This language is a religious and political statement. They are saying God is greater than the best human defense system we can devise. We are coming together to recognize that we have a power greater than we can devise and an allegiance greater than any of our political allegiances. And we are giving thanks for that God. But have you noticed, in the middle of verse 7 in this psalm, there is an abrupt interruption to the praise. Probably in its original context, the people are singing this psalm, and the priest jumps up and says, "Hold a minute, hold it, stop everything. Stop your singing, stop your praising." And he says, "Oh, that today you would listen to his voice." That's a warning that needs to come in every worship service we have. Oh, that today you would listen to his voice. We cannot afford to get so caught up in thanksgiving for the goodness of God that we forget God's call to compassionate justice in the world. The priest throws water, cold water, on their celebration. He reminds them that acts of justice and mercy a part of any act of thanksgiving. The divorcing of worship and compassionate justice turns poetic language into a sham. The prophets were particularly sensitive about this. Listen to the prophetic message. "When you stretch out your hands, I will hide my eyes from you, even though you make many prayers. I will not listen. Your hands are full of blood. Wash yourselves. Make yourselves clean. Remove the evil from your doings before my eyes. Cease to do evil. Learn to do good. Seek justice. Rescue the oppressed. Defend the orphan. Plead for the widow." That was Isaiah. The prophet Amos is even more succinct. "Let justice roll down like waters, and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream." It is this creative tension between the joy of gratitude and praise on the one hand and the call for justice that we encounter in the Lord's Supper. We use poetic images. "This is my body given for you. This is my blood shared for you." We take in the divine, and our lives are changed. Some traditions call it by the ancient Greek word for thanksgiving. It is a Eucharist, a thanksgiving. But our thanksgiving is always shallow without that word of warning. "Oh, that today you would listen to his voice." Whose voice? The voice of Jesus. We love to hear the voice of Jesus say, "Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." We love to hear, "I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never be hungry, and whoever believes in me will never be thirsty." We affirm these precious promises in the Lord's Supper. But we also hear Jesus with a word of warning. Do you love me? Then feed my sheep. We hear the poetic words of Jesus saying, I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. I was naked and you gave me clothing. I was sick and you took care of me. I was in prison and you visited me. The loving promises and the challenging call to compassionate justice are Siamese twins joined at the chest. They beat with the same passionate, poetic heart. They are the complementary companions of our joyful feast of God.